Talk given Sunday, 11th February, 1979. The brain synthesizes our sense impressions mainly through our speech faculty. We are taught from our birth onwards by those around us how to do this. Hence, the brain, by the time we are youngsters, is already conditioned. The result is that our ordinary worldly consciousness is confined throughout our lives to sense and brain functioning. This is our unavoidable starting point. But dormant in us, the living organism, each one of us, dormant in us are sensitivities, potentialities, energy stirrings, which may break through our confinement. Insofar as these are in line with the universal life trends towards fulfillment for the human species, it is well with each of us if we let this come about by our perception and our cooperation with these life trends. The main life trend in man is for consciousness to realize release out of confinement within finitude, separateness, and hence lack of wholeness, within time and hence mortality, within fortuitous change and hence confusion, useless conflict, sorrow and disorder. To realize release out of all that into the consciousness of wholeness, holiness, which means of non-finitude, of immortality, of eternity. Do bear in mind that consciousness is not to be confused with our states of mind or with what some call the content of consciousness. It is, I think, more accurate to talk of one's psychical content and not the content of consciousness. Very different things indeed. What is actually evolving in the human race and will spell the complete fruition of man is the fruition of consciousness as it functions today in its limited way in each one of us into this consciousness of totality. Such is the life trend in and for man. But here our difficulties begin. How can we perceive this? the race of man as a whole has no perception of it. All sorts of philosophies are produced, even mystical philosophies and so forth. They too inevitably mislead in some degree or other, for the simple reason that the instrument of expression of what the few might perceive is an instrument, namely concepts and words, which do not belong to the transcendent context. The transcendent context, which is the true context of religion in its ultimate nature, is one which is not different from our limited context, our faulty context. It completely subsumes this which is limited in that which is the unlimited. This which is the disharmonious into that which is utterly whole and holy. This is something we must never forget. If that were not the case, then our whole existence is useless, so to say. There is no emergence of purpose, is a bad word. Practically any word we use is inadequate. There is no emergence of true fulfillment for the human species. Every single thing that there is in the universe, the species to which it belongs, has its own specific flowering, its own specific blossoming and fulfilling. And so similarly, the human species has its specific blossoming. But since that belongs to a transcendent context, which is not other than, but subsumes this context, therefore, all our concepts and words which belong to this context, and we have no other concepts and words, are often misleading rather than helpful. And yet there is no other instrument we have available for us as we are here now in order to realize this. But there is a link. There is a link. The transcendent, as I said just a little earlier, is dormant in us. These sensitivities, potentialities, energy stirrings, which may break through our confinement. So how can we perceive this? Bear in mind that almost everyone is held fast by his conditioning in the prison of his own ignorance. Each man does not even know that he is ignorant. He's quite unaware. He's ignorant of his ignorance, of the life trend, and of the nature and scope and, of course, the meaning and significance of that fulfillment. He is ignorant of the fundamental fact that his mode of awareness of existence is in terms of the worldly, enslaved, subhuman. Often it is truly brutish and not in terms of the creative, free, fully blossomed human. I'm not using the word subhuman pejoratively. I'm using it simply in this sense that when the full development of man has come into being and is a realized fact, then only we are truly human. And if we take the trouble to investigate the meaning of the word human, of the word man, you will discover it is identical with the meaning of the word God. This is the extraordinary thing about it. Merely hearing or reading such words does not liberate us, or if you like, our consciousness. Why? Because our conditioning compels us to interpret it all in the subhuman way. We are conditioned in such a way that we always interpret in a subhuman way. And subhuman simply means the one who has not yet reached full humanity. That is all. There is nothing, no insult is meant there. We cannot understand the truth, the truth. We cannot see the whole fact immediately with unerring insight. All our perceptions are indeed, as Mahayana Buddhism, for instance, puts it, no perceptions. That is, in terms of the transcendent context, there are no perceptions. We could say, without fear of being wrong, that all our perceptions are distorted perceptions and sometimes complete misperceptions. When we do see a flash of the truth, how many of us cooperate or even can cooperate with it? So much with regard to the difficulties. Now, let us go a little more deeply into it. And I'm going to take a few passages from the Diamond Sutra, the Mahayana, of the Mahayana, the Vajra Chedika. Vajra means a diamond. It also means a thunderbolt. Vajra. Clear as a diamond. The Chedika means the splitting up, the tearing up, the analysis. But of course, analysis is the very thing that doesn't exist in transcendence. Transcendence is an integrated whole, always, perpetually, everlastingly, immortally, eternally. Analysis can take place up to a certain point where concepts and words at our level are concerned, only in order to enable us to see truly the futility of our concepts and words with regard to the transcendent reality. But when we have seen, when we really have seen the futility and the mistakes, when we have eliminated, therefore, by actually seeing the mistakes, all our mistakes, then what is there but the reality, the truth, undistorted, unhindered by us mistaken folk? You see, it's in a sense the via negativa. We have to negate all that resists, all that obstructs transcendence from coming to full fruition through each one of us as the perfect man. It is God, if you like, who comes to fulfillment and fruition. Not one of us enters the kingdom of heaven or nirvana, or attains this, that, or the other, or possesses it. It is transcendence, it is the whole which comes to fruition through each and every single manifestation throughout the entire cosmos. You see, one of the consequences of really seeing that, not just as a thought or so many words, but if you really see it, what happens to self-conceit? Out it goes. To pride. To all sorts of selfness, self-evaluations, self-esteem, and all the rest of it. It has no place whatsoever in our lives then. What a burden we can shed. And our values, the values which we hold dear in life, we discover that a whole lot of them, and our virtues in our dualistic, subhuman sense, what happens to them? They and their opposite numbers, vices, both become non-existent. And the one transcendent virtue, and virtue means the strength and power of the soul, a transcendent reality, that virtue is embodied in the individual himself. He is virtue embodied. He is the sinless one. He is the harmless one, therefore. Now, so we'll look into just a few bits here and there of the Diamond Sutra. And as you know, Mahayana Buddhism is, in a sense, called the Bodhisattva path. And Bodhisattva simply means wisdom being. Bodhi, wisdom, sattva, being. A wisdom being is a Bodhisattva. The Lord said, the Lord meaning the Buddha, the Lord said, "Hear, O Subhuti," the disciple who was a perfected holy one, remember, very high grade person altogether. Subhuti was the perfected holy one who was described as the one who was foremost in living in peace. And the meaning of that peace is not our meaning, which is a worldly meaning, but that transcendent peace. So he says to, the Lord says, "Here, Subhuti, someone who has set out on the path of a bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner." First difficulty, produce a thought. Our thinking is just our ordinary mental chatter, silent chatter. That's what our thinking is. And yet there is no other language one can use. "As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, all these I must lead to nirvana, into that realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana." And why? That is to say, why do I say this? And if in a bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a bodhi being, a bodhisattva. And why? He is not to be called a bodhi being in whom the notion of a self, of a being, should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. You see the difficulty in understanding this sort of scriptural writing. A statement is made and then it is contradicted at once. But a little bit more difficult is to come. Now, a little further on, Subhuti, in these bodhisattvas, those who are true bodhisattvas, no perception of a self, a separate self, takes place. See the implications at once. No perception of a separate self takes place. No perception of a being, of a soul, of a person. Nor do these bodhisattvas have a perception of a dharma or of no dharma. We'll go into the meaning of dharma in a minute. No perception or non-perception takes place in them. Now, these words which are used, no perception of a self understood as the existence of an ego as distinct from the five constituents of the psychophysical being. And in the Buddhist analysis, as you know, the five constituents are presented as form, feeling, perceptions in our sense of the word, volitions, and discriminative consciousness. Emphasize the discriminative, because it is the discriminative consciousness which functions in us, which separates things. So, no perception of an ego being defined as that of which we could say, this is mine, I am this, this is myself, myself as a separate self. If one can appreciate all the implications here, one would see how all the sources of ill in the world are just done away with. Now, a being, that is, no belief in a continuous, separate individual, identical with himself at different times, who could validly differentiate his internal constituents from what is outside him. We are very self-conscious, aren't we? Vividly self-conscious, as separate beings. But in actual fact, just to confine ourselves to the human species, each and every single one of us is so completely interrelated that if one really perceives that, and that perception is natural to us all the time, all through the day, who is the other fellow? There is no other fellow. It is all oneself. Or if you like, it is all the other fellow. The entire human race of 4,000 million people is all one fellow. So you see, the root source of conflict and enmity and all the rest that is involved, jealousy, competition, envy, hatred, all that goes out. As and when one sees it with that intensity, that it has become, the truth has become part and parcel of one's natural state of consciousness. Now, no perception of a soul, that is, no belief in the existence of a unifying and vivifying force within an individual organism, which for the span of a lifetime would persist from conception to death. No perception of a person, that is, no belief in the existence of a permanent entity who would migrate from birth to birth. No such entity. What happens to all our wonderful ideas, specially held so tenaciously all through Asia, of reincarnation? Of rebirth, or to use the Greek words transmigration and metempsychosis and metensomatosis and palingenesis and so forth. What happens to all those wonderful cobwebs spun by the brain, which functions at the most limited, the concretest level and expression of universal mind? You see how we hold on to a separate ego. And as long as we hold on to separateness, we shall inevitably have conflict. We shall inevitably have unfulfillment, sorrow, hatred, the absence of anything which is even the shadow of the reality of love, of wholeness, of holiness. Now, the last four items refer to misconceptions about the nature of dharmas current among Buddhists. No perception of a dharma. That is, the bodhisattvas know that dharmas do not exist, and they reject the abhidharmist conception of a multiplicity of separate dharmas. The abhidharma is the deeper psychological teaching which comes in the Pali Canon, which forms part of the Pali Canon. Now, they postulated so many dharmas. Dharmas in this context meaning fundamental essences, the building blocks, so to say, of the whole of the psychical nature. The fundamental building blocks. Just as in chemistry we had up till the end of the last century practically, the idea of the chemical elements, the 92 chemical elements, as the fundamental building blocks of the universe. And then when one fine day we managed to enter into the realm of the subatomic, then we discovered that these chemical elements were not building blocks, were not the fundamental building blocks. There is something more fundamental, and we thought we would come to a unity. But where science is concerned, what has happened is that instead of the subatomic world consisting of revealing to us some fundamental energy or force or whatever it is from which everything else has come into being, we now have, to our dismay, a little over 200 subatomic particles, as contrasted with the 92 chemical elements of ordinary chemistry. This is the charm of the creative, the primordial creative energy whose variety is utterly endless. You can't intrude into the mystery of transcendence. Let transcendence take hold of you, and you have that is quite sufficient. So now, that is rejected. Then, no perception of a no-dharma. And that for one reason specially, the negation of these multiple dharmas opens up one vast emptiness. This no dharma is more real than the dharmas, but cannot be the object of any possible perception by us as we are. That has to be remembered. Now, with respect to the meaning of dharmas, it's rather important to look into this. There are several meanings. The word itself is derived from dri, meaning to uphold. Now, most of you have heard that 100 times if you've heard it once. Dri, to uphold. The dharma, therefore, is that which is fundamental, underlies everything. In an ontological sense, dharma is a transcendental reality which is real in absolute truth and in the ultimate sense. This is the ontological definition of dharma. Nirvana is the dharma which is the object of supreme knowledge or the supreme dharma. Now you see, this definition in itself introduces contradictory elements. But I won't go into that because it'll take up all our time to go completely into the analysis of any one of these definitions. The next meaning, dharma is the order of law of the universe, immanent, eternal, uncreated. This is of special importance because right at the beginnings of the great spiritual teachings or revelation, if you like to use the word, of the whole of the Indo-European race, way back in the Rig Veda, we have the presentation of this order of law of the universe, immanent, eternal, uncreated. It's called Ritta. And the so-called gods, the great gods, the Adityas as they are called, the great gods of the Rig Veda, are described as the sons of Ritta, of eternal order. This eternal order is something which is an energy, a power inherent in anything and everything. It's inherent in it. If it were not there, this thing wouldn't be there at all. So it's very interesting to see that centuries later, after the Rig Veda, this comes something like 1500 years after the compilation of the Rig Veda. You see, this is presented in Mahayana Buddhism. Another meaning of dharma is a truly real event. Things are seen when dharma is taken as the norm. Again, you will find in the definition implied self-contradictions all along the line. I'm just trying to point out how difficult it is to penetrate into the innards of religious truth. We tend so glibly and facilely to talk about them and to deliver lectures and write treatises about them and so forth. I shiver with fear within my inner self, the fear of the Lord, when I sit and talk to anybody about these things. Because throughout my life, I have discovered this at least. Life is a voyage of discovery. in the religious sense, in the truly human sense, we say that it is a voyage of discovery of the truth. Not at all. All I have discovered is that my life has been a voyage of discovery of all my mistakes and my ignorance. All the time I'm discovering I was wrong. No, it is not like this. It's something different. There is something better. There is something less misleading. You see? But as and when this process can come, if it does come, to its fulfillment, then there is pure knowledge here. A knowledge which leaves me unconditioned, free of the conditioned state. And that is liberation. And then there is no such thing as my personal consciousness, because consciousness is a universal reality. And what we commonly call my consciousness is the same as God consciousness, if you like, or the universal consciousness, cosmic consciousness. And you see, therefore, that this has nothing to do with the common garden conception of cosmic consciousness, that you know everything in the universe, what is going on in people's minds and what is happening in other places. In the manner in which we acquire innumerable bits of knowledge, it's nothing to do with that. How does your health, if your body is perfectly healthy, how does it function? It functions perfectly consciously, but you'd say, oh, I don't know anything about it, I'm perfectly all right, and I don't bother about it, it's there. That is consciousness at work. You see? Said he very positively. Now, it also means a characteristic, a quality, a property, an attribute. Now we get smaller and smaller meanings, and the whole business of dharmas gets rejected when you really have your eyes opening. Next, we have a very important meaning of dharma. Now, this is a very practical meaning. Dharma means, as far as it is reflected in our conduct in everyday life, it means the moral law. Now, here we talked about the order of law of the universe. And in the Rig Veda, Varuna, the great god Varuna, is the embodiment of morality. Morality not as defined in the dictionary. Morality, which is a moral, which is the moral imperative deriving from transcendent absolute virtue, which is the power that releases cosmos into being out of chaos. Quite a different thing. So, here in our life, this moral law, righteousness, virtue, right behavior, duty, and religious practice has to play its part in our specialized, particularized forms, and they are specialized and particularized because we are human beings. If we were dogs, we would have quite a different morality. If we were ants, if we were termites, if we were beasts of prey, the Lord God made us like that, and it is our glory to be beasts of prey, naturally, spontaneously. Then we do nothing beastly. It is only us human beings who have the power to be bestial. We are animal organisms, simply as organisms, but we are not good animals. We are evil animals. Let us see the fact. Really see that fact. Not merely acknowledge it with a kind of a blind faith. See that fact. When you see that fact, the evil, which is our psychical energy expressing itself wrongly, it transforms into the right expression. That is purification. You can't cultivate virtue. It is there. It's constitutive of you, the human being. The Dharma, in this sense, is the whole of the religious life. Now, I think that should be sufficient where Dharma is concerned. So, we come back to this, that the Bodhisattva sees, has no perception of a Dharma or a no Dharma. Now, you see what is implied there? The opposites as they exist and function in our everyday dualistic life and consciousness are not mechanically synthesized into a whole. They are integratively unified into the wholeness, which means that in the inner deeps of your consciousness, the sense of separate selfness is diminishing. The consciousness in terms of us as an active, real fact in our lives grows. And insofar as that consciousness of us grows and grows and embraces all creation ultimately, then good and evil in our dualistic sense has no meaning. Instead of being irreconcilable opposites, you have converted them in your own being and in your own life as polar complementaries, not merely as polar complementaries, but as an inseparable unity. So you see, if that happens, and when that happens, the fulfillment of the moral imperative in you is invariably different according to the circumstance and is invariably right. It is harmless in this sense that it is in tune with the life trend, the universal life trend, the transcendent life trend functioning through you as a member of the human species. And it brings that, it helps to bring that to fruition. Now, of course, I'm presenting it in conceptual forms and I'm trying to make them as logical as possible, but don't get misled by what I say, nor take what I say as something to be led by. Neither reject it out of hand, nor believe it. Consider it. That is all. Consider it, look into it, let it yield up its secret, its true meaning. And that is the way of spiritual development, of religious fulfillment, which means of human fulfillment, because the human being is essentially a religious being, and only secondarily is he a political, social, economic animal. If that holds good, then he is a good animal, the animal part of him, his psychophysical organism, and he is well on the way, at least, to true humanness, true humanity, which is real godliness. Now, thank you. Yes. Now, a word in connection with this word perception. The Abhidharma of the Pali Canon teaches that the specific function of perception consists in taking up an object, noting and recognizing it, seizing upon it. Now you see, this is a very true definition of the word. Consider the word. In our own language, English, perception comes from per, P-E-R, through, and the root is cap, from which is the Latin capio, capere, capi, captum. Capere. Capio, I capture. I take hold of. You see? If I take hold of, if I capture, what have I done? I have separated something. Put it in my pocket, or on the mantelpiece, or in the bank, or whatever it is. You see? You see immediately the sundering of the unity of the universe. We have got hold of something. We talk of get hold of this idea. The nations have done it to the detriment of the human race through the millennia. They get hold of an idea. And we all still are foolish enough to take pride in saying, you can't kill an idea. Give them the right idea. Yes, you can't kill the idea. What do you do instead? You kill millions of human beings. Which would you prefer? No living creature in the world weeps for sorrow as man weeps. So it is to seize on anything, either a dharma or a no dharma, automatically involves an act of preference, bound up with self-interest, self-assertion, and self-aggrandizement, and therefore unbecoming to the selfless. Now, we come to some of the deep waters where we find contradictions coming along. Or rather, first of all, not a contradiction, but something of real value. Subhuti, the Bodhisattva, the great being, should produce an unsupported thought. That is, a thought which is nowhere supported, a thought unsupported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects, our thoughts and feelings, and the pictures in our minds and so forth. Unsupported by that. What is the implication? Examine our thought process, the nature of our thought process. It is completely conditioned by the fact that we have these five senses, and we have this internal sense which enables us to churn things up inside our brains. Our language is mainly responsible for that. You see? And it is all these things These are the energies, the forces, the actual forces at play, which give rise to our so-called thinking. But we are just limited to the five senses then. But supposing we could free ourselves from all this, then out of the context of finitude, of limitation, of mortality, and all that that involves, what happens? Consciousness is free in the realm of the infinite, the immortal, and the eternal. But you can't produce a thought in that transcendent context. How can you produce a thought in terms of infinity? You can't. Producing a thought means something which is separated, cut out. And this is the sinful state. This is the meaning of sin, the original meaning, that which sunders or tends to sunder the unity, the absolute unity of the universe. You see how deep this goes. So now we come to this difficult matter. Subhuti asked, "What then, O Lord, is this discourse on dharma? And how should I bear it in mind?" The Lord replied, "This discourse on dharma, Subhuti, is called wisdom which has gone beyond. And as such, you should bear it in mind." But look at the very next thing the Lord says. "Just that which the Buddha has taught as the wisdom which has gone beyond, just that he has taught as not gone beyond." Now, where are we? Through the fulfillment of the religiousness in us, our consciousness gets liberated out of the confined state into the unconditioned state. Is there a going beyond or going backwards or upwards or downwards in the unconditioned, transcendent, universal, absolute state? It's not possible. But you see, the influence of the truly perfected holy ones, like the great founders of the religions and other teachers like them, you see, this mysterious, indescribable, non-limitable power, this energy, is such that it awakens all those dormant sensitivities which lie hidden within the individual. And so he lives in conscious terms, not in our meaning of consciousness, discriminative consciousness, but in terms of total consciousness, in that state of infinity, immortality, and eternity. So you see, all that we say here is contradicted in actual fact, in the living experience of the perfected Holy One. So, that is why the Buddha says, that which the Buddha has taught as the wisdom gone beyond is indeed to be taught as the wisdom not gone beyond. And then the Buddha adds, that is why, O Subhuti, it is called the wisdom gone beyond. Now, what is the significance of this? And this is where I think so many people have slipped over the banana skin on the pavement. They say, but this is nonsensical, just a mess of absurd contradictions everywhere. Not at all. That is why it is called the wisdom gone beyond. Because when you are speaking to me, how else can you tell me about this apart from using language and concepts which belong to the realm of the limited, the mortal, the sorrowful, the conflicting, the dark. How else can you do it? So you see, this is only to name the thing. It is called the wisdom gone beyond. That's the name. But don't get deluded that this which is named the wisdom gone beyond is that natural wisdom, that transcendent wisdom which functions as a universal, eternal power throughout the entire cosmos and the not cosmos. You know, being and non-being, the existent and the non-existent, are always associated as inseparables in one transcendent, in this unimaginable wholeness in throughout the great religious teachings of India. Now, I trust that this has not confused you more than ever. If it has, say hooray. How nice. I hope it has not confused you more than ever, but has just given some indication of how we may approach the what we call the study of these scriptures. Study in its real sense, ultimate sense, is pure meditation at the transcendent level, not what we play about with every day in our lives, sitting cross-legged and making very pious gestures and having a holy smirk upon our faces. Not meditation in that sense, but the continuous meditation, which is the continuous mindfulness, the continuous functioning, quite naturally and spontaneously, of the fully human consciousness, which is God consciousness.